ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's not hard to fall in love with Sandra. I don't think I had to work on that. Building that chemistry was literally, I felt like as soon as I locked eyes with her and saw her, I was there, and I probably had to remind myself, hang on, I'm acting here. All right, get my head together.
This is Stop Everything, the show that makes you smarter about pop culture. Hello there, I'm Beverly Wang, and this week we're talking about HBO's adaptation of Viet Thanh Nguyen's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Sympathizer, about the aftermath of the war in Vietnam for a group of refugees who flee Saigon in 1975 and settle in California. And it's a spy thriller slash dark comedy.
Saigon. 1975. I was a man of two faces.
You are the only one I can trust.
The war was ending.
Yo!
And I awaited my new assignment.
My protege.
Jesus.
So where are we going?
To next harbor on your CIA voyage. America.
The star of this series is Australian actor Hua Shande, and it's a huge lead debut for him. He plays the captain, a double agent spying for the Viet Cong alongside Hollywood heavyweights Robert Downey Jr. and Sandra Oh, and Hua Shande is with me now. Hua Shande, hello from Melbourne and welcome to Stop Everything.
Hey, thanks for having me. Melbourne is actually the place where I grew up, so...
I know.
It's nice to hear people from back home.
Yeah. So I just want to know how it's all sinking in with The Sympathizer, because this is a huge deal. You are the star of the most prestige of prestige television that we can basically make in the world. It's HBO A24, based on a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel. Park Chan-wook is a director. You've got these heavyweights like Robert Downey Jr. and Sandra Oh co-starring alongside you. It's an incredible trajectory. How are you taking it all in?
You know, when I first saw the audition notice and I saw all of the people that were involved, I was like, there's no way. It would be like winning a lottery if you were to get it. 9 months later, through all the hoops and hurdles that they threw at me, through all the travels and all the callbacks they did, and, you know, just wanting to give up and wanting to let go of the project so many times, I felt like I won $1 billion, so to speak. I was going to say a million, but billion is, it fits more perfectly with how this prestigious production feels right now.
Yeah, what were some of the pinch me moments that you had during this whole process?
Well, getting it, like just to have, you know, the showrunner tell me at the very end on the Zoom, just to say that, but we want you to play the captain. It felt like a huge relief because the audition process was so exhausting. But then like to step on set for the first time, to be as green as I was, but then to, I guess, do scenes with Sandra and Robert, and then to be directed by director Park, knowing full well that, you know, the HBO executives and the A24 executives and Team Downey, you know, and Susan would be watching your dailies every single day. There are moments I would sit down during my breaks and look out over the set and just think to myself, are they serious? Like, have I somehow conned my way into getting here? Did I fool them all? It was unbelievable. I kicked myself a lot of the times when I sat there and just was like, I'm doing this.
Yeah, it's life-changing.
Yeah.
You mentioned this lengthy audition process. I've read a little bit about it. There were long periods where you were simply like in Sydney and waiting. Can you talk a little bit about those different stages of auditioning for the role of the captain and what was required of you?
The first audition came in January of 2022. At first, they obviously wanted to see me, you know, put down my take of the scenes that they gave me. I was familiar with the book at the time, but I made sure to read the book by, you know, when this audition process started getting serious. But they wanted to see if I was proficient, at least on a basic level with the Vietnamese language. So I had to do that in my first audition as well. And then 2 weeks later, I got a call back from the casting director all the way in New York. And I did the same scenes, but live to her so that she could just see that I was able to do this on my own volition, that I wasn't just, you know, reciting like a parrot. Every month after that, I think as it started to get serious, I was Zooming with the casting director. I would do other tapes. Director Park hopped on the Zoom. And then every month after that, it was just like a different callback with a different scene with different people on the Zoom, basically honing in on seeing whether I could do the different things that was required with the complexity of this character. By July, sort of 7 months into the process, they got serious and they flew me out to Korea to meet Director Park, to do these different scenes for him in person. And then I had dinner with him. We basically talked about the book and the character and just really got into the nitty-gritty of really fleshing out what it was that I wanted to do with this character and how I wanted to tell this story and how we wanted to tell this story. It wouldn't be till another month after they flew me back and literally having heard nothing and thinking to myself that I blew it somehow, they called me back again in August and flew me to LA to do the same thing in front of Don McKellar this time and the other producers in the room. I remember thinking to myself, this had to be it. This had to be it. Like, there's no other way that they could just stretch this out anymore. And then I went back home after that in August and I sat around for a whole nother month, just racking my brain, just thinking to myself, what have I said? What have I done? Trying to move on with it all. And then they told me in September that I got it.
Oh my God. I mean, and this is all volunteer at this point. It's not like you've been hired. This is just trying out for it.
Yeah, this is part of the process.
That's wild.
And, you know, a part of me was thinking, is this how you make it onto a prestigious, you know, HBO production? Is this how you do it?
It must be. Look, like listening to you talking about looking at over the set and feeling the pressure, but also that process of like trying and just not sure and not hearing, it kind of makes me think about in some way how it kind of parallels the trajectory of the captain. Because we watch the series and the captain spends a lot of time waiting, wondering, what is going on?
Yeah.
And then kind of...
Well, the anxiety and the trauma.
Exactly. And yeah, the pressure of all of that. I mean, it's not the same, obviously, but there's interesting parallels. And that character, the captain, is so interesting for so many reasons because, like you mentioned, bilingual role, right? Mm. But it's always a character who is also acting the part of a double agent. The captain is never just like baseline, this is me. It's like layered upon layer upon layer.
Yes.
Of how do you act in certain situations? Do I have to smile now? How do I obfuscate? And so how do you convey that layered double agent acting as an actor? Because it's a lot going on. It must mess with your head.
It's funny, you know, when you were saying about the audition process, and to be honest, you know, partway through it and even towards the end, I sat there thinking to myself, are they just preparing me for the role by just traumatizing me and
psychological torture?
Yeah, really just getting into my head about everything. But, you know, I guess that's just what it was. They were really careful in trying to figure out the person who could play this complex character that's more than just being a double agent and playing allegiances. I think it's really easy to sort of just try and play like a double agent. And, you know, a lot of the times when we think of spies, you know, you think of a person running around with a gun and lying all the time. And, you know, there's explosions in the background and then you're just basically trying to, you know, smirk your way out of everything. But I really wanted to get to the core of this character. I really wanted to find out who this person emotionally was and what his beliefs were. And so I did a lot of just reading and researching into, I guess, things that were around the period of the time, especially for a character to have to live through the Vietnam War and post-Vietnam War and to have to survive amongst refugees and people who escaped the war. And I just remember reading so many stories that I found across the web from the Vietnamese perspectives of people who had to survive and struggle and what it was like to even have to survive against their own Vietnamese people or American GIs who were like trouncing upon their villages and what they felt like. And so I carried a lot of those stories with me in trying to portray this role. And so for me, once I got to the core of what that character's psychology and the beliefs were, I guess I just laid on, you know, how I would act to certain people, who I believed were my friends, who I believed were my enemies, who I believed were against me, who I believed that would stick to me towards the end. When you think about things in that way, you don't have to act so much about the layers. You just feel it as you feel your way through these scenes. And, you know, you keep it as simple as you can. If you have done the embodiment of what you believe your character is, you put yourself in these situations and you just feel it out as you go. If you believe in this thing, would you want to confront this person in this situation or would you want to hide from them?
What was director Park Chan-wook's, you know, when you met with him and he told you why he wanted to tell this story, what was the appeal for him as a Korean director? Did the history of Korea also play into this?
When I had dinner with him, I spoke to a lot of the parallels, I guess, even between Korea and Vietnam in that historical aspect, you know, because both countries have been divided and both countries have had a very brutal civil war. One has ended, obviously. What I found really interesting about, I guess, his passion and wanting to be involved in telling this story is that you know, he understood what it was to have people divided on ideology and beliefs. And, you know, amongst the brothers, the Blood Brothers, me and Fred, who plays Bon, and Zui, who plays Man, you know, although we're childhood friends and we are characters that grow up together through this tumultuous time, there's certain beliefs and ideologies that push and pull us apart. And I think director Park was really good at giving us tips and tricks in order to help build those physical relationships as well. And, you know, there's certain scenes where just having the captain be a little bit more uneasy and a little bit more unstable, and then having a character like Bond being completely in control, really tells the visual story of what that relationship looks like. So yeah, director Park was really good at giving those specific detail-oriented framing of characters for us to work within.
And the whole time he's directing via an interpreter, right? What was that experience like? Did you feel like you could understand immediately, or even that process being mediated is so interesting?
Yeah, it's really funny, huh? Like if you think about it, like the director-actor relationship is quite intimate, and sometimes it just needs, you know, quick shorthand so you're able to get into the ease of being able to figure out what's required in the scene and all that sort of stuff. But his interpreter is, you know, probably one of those skilled persons I've seen on set. And he was able to relay and respond immediately with our conversations. And the thing with director Park is that he's a man of very few words. So he only needs to get out ideas and, you know, thoughts for you to be able to sort of latch onto so that you can build upon that. And so at first it was kind of daunting. I found myself saying to even the other castmates, being like, when director Park speaks, do you look at the interpreter or do you look at him?
And what did you land on? What do you do?
You just look and respond to him, and the interpretation's coming through your ear.
Wow.
Because that's how quick and seamless it was. At first it was like, okay, how does this work? But, you know, the more you work at it and the more you just understand that he's really quick at getting what he needs to get out. It's only a couple of things and ideas that he's trying to get within you. The interpretation comes seamlessly, and you're just watching and feeling him, and almost just watching his body language as he's describing things to you.
That's incredible. And so, like, when it came to you speaking Vietnamese, as an immigrant child myself, someone being like, speak in your family's native language, all of a sudden I'm feeling very anxious because I know I speak like a primary school age child. How was that for you?
Exactly, because I didn't grow up speaking even Vietnamese, which is a little bit shameful, I think, now that I think of it. But I kind of tried to remove myself from the language because I just didn't feel like it was really a part of me. And so when, you know, you're given projects like this that require a surmountable amount of Vietnamese and, you know, really complicated grammatical sentences that are beyond your basic everyday, like, hello, you know,
hello,
I'm
auntie.
Hungry,
yes.
Where's the bathroom, you know
exactly.
What I mean? Like
yeah.
A tourist guide to vacationing abroad or something, you know, yeah. When you're given complex sentences that deals with ideas and things that are thematic to the book, you know, you have to have an understanding of grammar that is beyond the rudimentary. So they put me into a 2-week crash course.
2 weeks?
Yeah, just to brush up on like grammar, spelling, reading, writing, so that they could give me a script so that I could just read it and then learn from it that way. But to say that I wasn't familiar with Vietnamese is not, you know, quite correct. You know, I'd heard the language from my parents growing up. I just chose not to speak it. So I had a basic understanding of it. But now I guess I was just building upon, you know, upgrading my language ability to be able to speak it more fluidly. And once I got the scripts, I just diligently read it, worked through it, tried to make it as natural as I could. And by the time I started shooting, you know, I was saying sentences more than just parroting. Like I was actually understanding and I was able to feel and, you know, like as we would fluidly speak as we are, I was able to do that in Vietnamese.
That's kind of a cool side effect now. Does that mean like when you talk to your family and your relatives that you are more comfortable speaking to them in Vietnamese?
Yeah, definitely.
That's
now
really cool.
I am, I would say so, yeah. But it would be so uncomfortable for me to do it before, but now just, you know, having had to speak it for almost 6 months, a part of me is just like, there I am. That's what I could have been sounding like all these years.
Oh, but that's a cool that you can do it now. That's awesome. And what about, like, when it comes to then speaking an American accent, is that then just a walk in the park for you, or did you have to work on that as well?
It's not exactly a walk in the park, but it comes much more easily than speaking Vietnamese. And even now, I find myself here in the States, because when I did it for the role. I stayed in it. I didn't just do it for the role. As soon as I hopped off the plane to start the production, I was in the accent, and I just stayed in the accent for the entirety of the time. And so now when I'm here in the States and I talk to people, it's actually a lot easier for me to put on my American accent and talk to people.
Because you probably get fewer questions, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And also, you know, like, I've been auditioning and I've done quite a few other American production, so it's not like it was completely strange to me. So that was definitely much easier for me to tackle than speaking Vietnamese.
On the personal front then, I mean, I know that your family are Vietnamese refugees that came to Australia, like so many people did. How has this process, you know, helped you understand that experience from a different way? I've read interviews with Sandra Oh where she talks about how she now thinks about that war differently and refers to it differently, not the Vietnam War, but the war in Vietnam. I'm wondering, like, you have such a close connection to this story. It's literally like you're playing the role of people who are your elders. What has that been like in terms of understanding or adding layers to that understanding of that war?
You know, I guess when I was growing up, my parents would tell me about the trauma and the devastation and the loss of belonging and what they had to struggle through to survive, to make a new life for themselves and all that sort of stuff. But when you're young and, you know, you're immature, and it just sounds like your grandparents telling you, back in my day, you know, and it's kind of sad that I felt that way. But I think a lot of that also comes from the fact that, you know, growing up in Australia and a lot of the Western world, their depictions of the Vietnam War or the war in Vietnam, it is probably more correctly to
be perceived.
Or
the American Wars, it's referred to.
Yeah, or the American Wars, it's termed in Vietnam. It's, you know, a lot of the times these perspectives and stories and traumas have been disregarded. They've been made to feel insignificant. And so therefore, you know, when we refer to that conflict, we refer to it in a very specific way because of the way that it's been depicted to us for decades. So for me now, watching this and having just done, I guess, a lot of reading and a lot of watching of documentaries, you know, Vietnamese specific documentaries as well, you know, not just your everyday documentaries that we're used to seeing, it gives me more of an appreciation for the struggles and the traumas that we're not used to seeing. And I think for the vast majority of the Vietnamese diaspora who've had to, I guess, escape the war, now watching something like this, I hope it gives them some sort of clarity or feeling of significance or feeling of, you know, that their stories are just as important, because we've tried to accurately tell some of these moments in this part of our history in a way that isn't from the Western perspective anymore, that isn't clean, that isn't just, you know, two-dimensional, that it's so varied and multidimensional, and there are different beliefs and psychology around it. Yeah.
It is so interesting, right? Because when I think about Vietnam War, you know, screen content, immediately I was like, Oliver Stone, Platoon, Born on the 4th of July.
And Apocalypse Now.
Yes, exactly. And there's shades of that, like The Sympathizer addresses those kinds of things in later episodes. But what the baseline story is so different. It's, you know, the complexity of these migrants, these refugees now who are now having to rebuild their lives in a new land and figuring out loyalties and whether the loyalties still apply in this new place. It's a really, really, really interesting series. I want to talk about a little bit about starring alongside Robert Downey Jr. and Sandra Oh. First of all, let's talk about Robert Downey Jr. because he, talking about surreal upon surreal, he's playing multiple roles.
Yeah.
And there's one scene in a steakhouse where you are engaging with four of them.
Yeah.
What was it like to shoot that? And how was that like to interact with him in all those different guises at the same time?
Look, it was so bizarre. And, you know, knowing that this scene was going to be coming up for us to shoot, I was kind of looking forward to it. I was ready for it because, you know, for probably the one of the few times in shooting this project, I felt like I could just relax and watch the drama unfold in front of me as opposed to me having to be a part of it. But it was really fun because watching Robert assume all these different roles and characters, you know, he's got so many characters in his everyday life that comes out of him, and we're only able to craft four of them in this show for him.
Well, is he always just like falling into like a different character in the regular life?
Yeah, he's just a very wild, funny, goofy, down-to-earth dude that just loves to play and have fun. And so watching him assume all these different roles, sometimes I would have to pull myself back and be like, I have different relationships with each of these characters of his, and I need to remember what they mean to me and who they are to me. But sometimes I get caught up in the play of it all that I forget, hang on, wait, how does the captain feel towards the professor or the congressman or the auteur or Claude, you know? Robert is a master of, I guess, character in disguise. And when we started filming that scene, you know, I think we started off filming with Claude, the CIA operative. And as soon as I had that relationship with him, he would go and get changed and then 2 hours later dress down and then 2 hours more to dress up as his next character. He'd come in with a completely set of new costume and makeup and a character, and then he'd sit down in front and we'd do the same scene again, but with his interpretation of that other character that we...
Did it mess with his head? Must have messed with your head, but did it mess with his head?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm sure there were a few times when Director Park had to pull him up and be like, hang on, where are we? You know, let's get back to...
Who are you?
...other character that we found. And it took 3 days to film, and it was just really fun to watch him at work, but also I'm having to imagine what his other three characters are doing while he's doing his other one character, and then we'd have to reshoot multiple takes just because my response to how he would do his other characters wasn't quite how he would actually do it. Yeah.
That's wild. Okay, what about Sandra Oh? It's an honor just to be Asian. You know, she is our role model.
Yeah.
But in this situation, you're meeting her and you're having to do some pretty intimate scenes with her. So I must ask, what is it like to act in a sex scene opposite Sandra Oh?
You know, I think that was the last thing I was thinking about, just because I was just afraid of everything else, you know, just even just working with an actor on that caliber. And then, you know, when I first met her, I couldn't help but be a bit of a fanboy. And it was so funny, you know, Director Park and Don McKellar had to remind me, hang on, who's the captain here? You've got to remember what your character is. And I was like, oh, yeah, sorry. I just caught myself a little bit there. I was just being Hua for a second.
Yeah,
there, sorry.
Understandable. Totally understandable.
Yeah, but she's so lovely and generous, and she really guided me through this process, you know. She gave me a lot of good advice. And when you're stepping into a set like this and you're a bit green and you don't know what the expectations are and you don't know how to set boundaries as well, she really stepped in and just looked after me in that way and would speak up on my behalf when I wasn't sure about things. So, you know, I lent on Sandra as much as I did with Robert as well. And it's not hard to fall in love with Sandra. I don't think I had to work on that, you know. Building that chemistry was literally, I felt like as soon as I locked eyes with her and saw her, I was there, and I probably had to remind myself, hang on, I'm acting here. All right, get my head together. But yeah, look, when we did that scene, we kind of just leapt into it. She's so good at relaxing you and so good at allowing you to not feel inhibited because she's so supportive. So she doesn't make you feel weird about choices. She doesn't make you feel like, you know, something is unnatural or unwarranted. She's just like, allow it, do anything. And, you know, we'll talk about labor if it doesn't feel right. So mm-hmm. I really appreciated that she just trusted me as I trusted her.
That sounds like an amazing experience. I also want to ask about working with the legendary Vietnamese actress Kyu Chin, because
yeah.
I know her as the mother in the Joy Luck Club, but she has had a huge long career, and she actually fled Saigon.
Yes.
In real life, and she's having to come back and do it again. What was it like to work with her? And I guess also have so many Vietnamese cast members on set must have been a really unique experience.
Yeah. When I think about, you know, after episode one, the fall of Saigon, as we're all making our escape. And I just remember shooting that scene, and it took about 4 or 5 nights to shoot across because it was such a big set piece, you know, that we had half a Hercules built in the back of a truck and all these lights that were rigged up and explosion, you know, faux explosions and, you know, all these extras running around and, you know, people doing stunts all over the place. And then we had to film this whole thing in the middle of everything and run and back and forth all night, you know, 4 nights in a row. And I remember just Kyu Chin talking to us about the gravity of all of this and just in the setting that we were, you know, thanks to, you know, the set design and the art department, the way we were shooting this, it just felt so real. And hearing how Kyu Chin was describing that this was so almost parallel to how she was escaping the fall of Saigon at the time, I felt like it weighed on all of the Vietnamese cast, you know, let alone the whole production, but all of us to feel like we had to not just act out these moments, but be in these moments as if it were our parents or people before us who had to make this perilous journey. And so hearing her tell stories similar, if not the same, as what was depicted at the end of episode one, it gave us a responsibility to tell this story. And I think when we did it, we all felt so proud of having the ability to do this for people who actually had to live it, like Kilchin.
It's so personal, isn't it, to kind of relive and find yourself in that position where you are basically reenacting that trauma. And especially with the explosions in that final part of that episode are so powerful and so terrifying. I mean, that must have stayed with you for some time.
Yeah. There's a lot of, you know, sound and explosions that, you know, you don't necessarily feel on the day. But I got to be honest with you, having 200 extras running past you, around you, through you, all over the place, and everyone yelling, just hearing people yelling while you're running around trying to do these scenes is enough to instill that reality for you. You don't need much more than that to really remind you that this happened. It still happens.
Yeah. Washonde, you are like, you know, the man of the moment. You're the lead in this huge series. Imagine it's a huge jump from, you know, the long and torturous audition process, but even before that, the kind of opportunities you're getting compared to now. I mean, what are you hoping to do next in your career? Where do you want to go?
At the moment, I'm kind of just letting it all soak in. But I would love the ability to tell the second book within this series. You know, if we're so lucky to have that opportunity, I would love to be able to do that. But look, since I began doing this seriously, trying to be an actor, I've always wanted to tell stories that have moved people, that are thought-provoking, that have some sort of deep connection to people that is relevant in some way. So if I'm able to tell those stories moving forward, then I would be ever so grateful. But yeah, right now I'm just looking to find something else within my abilities to tell things that I care about.
Well, it'd be cool if maybe some of those opportunities arise also in Australia, not just Hollywood, and you can come back here and do a bit of work as well. It's been fantastic talking to you. I really want to thank you for your time and congratulations.
Thank you so much, Beverly, for having me.
This episode of Stop Everything was made on the land of the Kulin Nation on Whadjuk Noongar country and on the land of the Muwinina people from country around Nipaluna. Our producer is Sarah Mashman. Our executive producer is Tom Wright. And our sound engineer is David LeMay. Thank you so much for hanging out with me this week. I'll be back again next week with another fantastic conversation with the Guilty Feminists, Deborah Frances White. Now, remember, you can catch up on all Stop Everything episodes in the ABC Listen or all other podcasting apps if you're listening outside Australia. And if you enjoy the show, why not invite your friends to listen and follow as well? Tap that share button now on your device and send it to someone who you think will enjoy this conversation. Thanks so much, and I will catch you next time.